sign up for our free newsletter at pmorin.org. I will put the link in the notes below. And also consider supporting us on Patreon. We have three different levels. There's something there for everybody. He says to deny the good in its fullness in the public order is to eliminate authority and set sheer power in its place. This is another great point. When you don't have that consensus in the public order, maybe particularly amongst the people in political and culturally powerful positions, okay, whatever we want to call that, if you don't have any sort of agreement, okay, and there is no aiming at a common good, then what's left in those positions is their sheer ability to force you to do things. And I think also this sense that people have that the government at various levels in our societies is simply ultimately a physically coercive force that's threatening, right? In some way, you know, through the tax codes or through various laws that regulate our economic behavior, you know, our movement and so on and so forth. It has that power, but it doesn't really have like authority, which would require a knowledge of goodness and a consensus, right? So we feel that, right? And this is particularly a problem, and it's hard. I know that people don't necessarily want to hear this because democracy is considered the best system now, pretty much, seems like. But democratic power is really a case in point for this lack of, you know, societal agreement on the good. Democratic power, both ancient and modern, basically allows a lot of just individual freedom, and then you know, whatever the majority says, right, in any given year. Okay, now that is not any sort of arrival at the good whatsoever. As I said at the beginning, you know, individuals can be very mistaken about what their good is. So at any given time, the majority may vote for something that's really bad for them and really bad for society. So there is no, you know, there is no automatic authoritative good that comes with democracy. In fact, democracy is kind of a denial, in a way, it's a denial that that's possible. So what we have in democracies is often the majority gets to decide on incredibly important moral issues, whether that's, for instance, the death penalty or what the policy should be on abortion or birth control or warfare, right? Whether we should kill people, literally, all of these things get regulated by the majority will, sometimes directly, but often indirectly through whom we vote for. When you think about it, that is really no way to arrive at what is actually good, but it is designed to keep the relative peace, right? If the majority, sometimes it's a bare majority, but if a majority votes for or against the death penalty, for instance, you're more likely to keep the peace with whatever it decides because it's the majority, okay? That has worked out somewhat. And none of these types of thinkers want to say that it has absolutely no merit. It's just to say that the democratic process is the height of what human beings can achieve, just doesn't make sense to them because basically it puts the most serious moral, social matters into the hands of the fleeting majority. When you think about it, that is the abdication of responsibility on the part of really everybody involved, but maybe particularly political, cultural, intellectual leaders. So at the beginning, I talked about how, you know, Schindler does not want a system of integralism in which the church more or less rules, right, and becomes more or less the head of the state. In other words, some type of, this is probably a misnomer to a certain extent, but just for purposes of understanding, some type of theocracy. He doesn't want some type of theocracy. What he wants is a system in which the authority of those whose lives and minds are aimed towards understanding the good to be recognized and to become kind of like the star that guides the political authorities or the political authorities to the extent that they are guided by that star have true authority and not just coercive power. So he's arguing that there ought to be two distinct spheres, the political and the religious, which in his view is the source, the best source of understanding the good, that there ought to be two distinct spheres, both aiming at a common good, but doing so differently, with one, the church, having more of a fuller grasp on authority and informing through not coercive means, but through agreement, the political sphere. He says, more specifically, the political includes every dimension of human existence, from the animal to the rational to the explicitly religious, but includes that whole specifically with respect to its bearing on the organization of society in this world. Obviously, the strictly spiritual dimension of human life is immediately relevant to existence in this world, as serious human beings have always recognized. It's more immediately relevant, even than the so-called material necessities of life. In this regard, the temporal ruling power is especially charged with the spiritual dimension of the common good, and so with the religious existence of the polis. This is nevertheless fundamentally different from saying that the defining end of the political order as such is the salvation of souls. So I kind of take that to mean that, you know, the political sphere would be subordinate to the church's authority to the extent that those in the political sphere were adherents to the church, okay, which obviously is problematic in a practical sense, okay, but still, and that the church would have no juridical authority outside of spiritual domains, but that the church, you know, would have that juridical authority and even the use of a sort of coercive force in its own realm. Now, before we start thinking pitchforks and bonfires, I think he's talking about things like excommunication. You know, like if you're a member of the church and you refuse to repent from some horrendous grave sin and the church excommunicates you, that would be within its juridical authority. So at any rate, the church would not have any of that outside of those spiritual concerns. Authority would not be then reduced to power, right, the use of coercive force, but would be based upon societal recognition of the authority that suffuses from the church through the political to the citizens, okay? He says only this formulation addresses human nature because human nature, he says, is essentially spiritual. And therefore, a political order that doesn't address the soul nature of human beings, you know, however you want to conceive that, but our inner integrity and, you know, the good that we aim at, any order that doesn't address that is not properly human. Okay. A good political order needs to help people flourish in their full humanity. Now, he does address the fact that we're living in different times where this type of political order seems way less conceivable, right? He says in the past, this was natural. You know, for instance, I mean, one, you know, obviously medieval Christianity. at least at the level of ideas, you know. And for a lot of people, the assumption being that the church did have that moral authority and that their political leaders were within the church and generally agreed with it. I mean, in practice, there was a lot of like conflicts too, as well. Like I would argue there were conflicts all along the way through the medieval era that ultimately led to, you know, the modern turn. Okay. But, you know, I mean, you could say in any traditional society that there has been much more of a convergence and not a separation between spiritual leadership and whatever counted for political leadership, okay? That the two were much more one, and this gave the political leaders this same authority. It led to more of a, or it enforced or reinforced a type of societal consensus. Okay. And I really do think this is what ultimately it's aiming at. And that's what he means by the polis was a manifestation of religious views. Okay. Or what I mean by it, paraphrasing him. Okay. The polis was a manifestation of the religious views of the Greeks, for instance. But you could say this of Native American tribes. You could say this of any sort of traditional society. And prior to the modern turn, this was still the case in Europe to a great extent. Now, obviously, our religious agreement has been shattered. The Protestant Reformation and the printing press guaranteed endless religious fracturing. And now we have, you know, the globalized information age, the internet. I mean, it is like the printing press on steroids. Doubled, squared. and then America, you know, the country that he seems to be aiming at here, was founded as a Protestant, if anything, a Protestant agglomeration, right? And even that, you know, not really, as he himself would admit, it wasn't really a Christian founding, even. It was a liberal founding, but primarily done by shades of Protestant, okay? And it was founded on some idea of separation. People argue about, well, exactly what it means, did separate, was it really, you know, complete separation? But surely we can agree that the American founding, I mean, the First Amendment enshrines religious freedom, right? And so the state cannot dictate, to people, you know, which way to worship or to worship at all. Okay. We studied a Jefferson quote last time that basically amounted to, it doesn't matter to me what anybody believes. Okay. That was kind of like the guiding principle there. So Schindler really swimming upstream, you know, in this type of environment, to hope that we could arrive at societal consensus about the good. Okay. And even more so that we might arrive at societal consensus or something like that regarding the good being of Catholic origin, right? So I tend to think, I more than tend to think that like I argued last time in a way, like we do have to account for what has transpired in this process, not just historically, but within our very souls and mentalities. And what has transpired has now become a part of our history. And it may very well be that we cannot really, we can be informed by the past, but we cannot recreate the past. And this is something I learned from Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age. I've done a whole series on this book, A Secular Age. So if you're interested in that, look for the playlist on that. But, you know, Taylor convinced me truly that we have a different consciousness now. And so we can admire the past and we can even try to incorporate in our own way aspects of it. But to move back into that mental and spiritual space is not possible. And therefore, to a certain extent, what Schindler is writing remains a philosophic work and a argument for changing the way individuals think about our situation in hopes of some sort of movement, you know, societal, cultural, political movement in that direction. But any movement in our current environment takes on the aspect of ideology, which it would not have done prior to the kind of separation of these matters that we have thoroughly internalized. Now, Schindler asks, you know, about the confessional state, which is a state in which perhaps the church is established, right? Even if it is not like a theocracy. Now, he wants to move away actually from the tendency we have to think of the confessional state as officially established, as in, you know, we now you guys are going to pay taxes to support this and you need to go to the official church. That he does, interestingly, argue is not currently possible or even desirable. So here's an aspect of Schindler's thought that does recognize this. We are in a different situation now. But on the other hand, he argues there never has been a non-confessional state in the sense that every state promotes a set of values, whether it wants to admit that or not. In our case, he says it's kind of a watered down and now secular Protestantism. So there he recognizes it. Okay, but if it is a watered down and secularized Protestant type of state, and that's what it confesses, then the vision seems to be even harder to imagine. Again, he makes the argument that the normal form of confessionalism ought to be the organic recognition by political actors of the actual tradition. But in his case, that actual tradition is the Catholic Church. He says the Catholic Church is the best expression of traditionality. And that probably has to be, I mean, you have to admit that's true in the sense of, you know, historically, the Catholic Church for so long was the only church embraced all of these traditions, the Greeks, the Romans, and the Jews. And brought them together and created, had a large hand in creating, you know, Western civilization. But then, you know, we did take this Protestant turn. And so while it is the perhaps the best expression of traditionality, it's a very open question whether it can gain more traction as it really is, as Schindler would conceive it, in this type of milieu. At any rate, he argues that the ideal state would realize the common good, and that is not the same as establishment. Well, here's a good quote that kind of sums things up. He says, "We are indeed affirming that ultimately a Catholic confessional state is the ideal, not in the sense that a modern liberal state subordinates itself to the church, but in the sense of a political order founded in the ecclesial order, at the center of which is the ultimate nature and destiny of man. But we make this affirmation indirectly and through an expansion of the intrinsic meaning of politics. An ideal political order is one that understands itself to be at the service of the whole human good, and this good transcends itself beyond the temporal horizon, opening up to the eschatological order for which the church is directly responsible." So there you have it. Thanks for listening, and remember to sign up for our newsletter. I've put a link in the notes below.